Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Servant Leadership Institute podcast. In this episode, we are delighted to present a conversation with Art Barter, founder and CEO of Servant Leadership Institute, and Todd Hunter, founding bishop of the Diocese of Churches for the Sake of Others, and author of our latest publication, Our Character at Work, Success from the Heart of Servant Leadership. Let's join these two leaders as they talk with warmth and wit about this new book, which focuses on changing your heart to truly become a leader who serves.
Well, we're excited today. Got a great guest with us today, Todd Hunter, a great friend. We've been together for, gosh,
7 years?
7 years, like right? Yeah, 7 years. Yeah. And we both have a great interest in servant leadership. He's also a bishop in the Anglican Church.
Your personal bishop.
My personal bishop, right. Mm-hmm. And when you get the call from the bishop, you take the call from the bishop.
Everybody needs a personal bishop.
That's right. Yeah, we do. We do. So Todd's been a great friend. We've been working with him on a book for our Servant Leadership Institute for basically church leaders or actually people just of faith.
Yeah.
Right? So, and it's Character at Work. And just came out, and we're excited about it. It's a publication of Servant Leadership Institute, and so we're going to talk about the book today, Todd, and ask you a little bit about, you know, what drove you to write this, what's in your heart for leaders, and how they can make the world better. And you know, we both share a passion in what I refer to as leadership malpractice in the world today. Others call it power leadership, but. There's all kinds of comments, but tell us a little bit about what drove you to get to this book.
Well, first of all, just in terms of our relationship, I think of the first day we were introduced by a mutual friend and sitting in your office, and almost immediately thought that we should do something together in the future.
So that's right. Yep.
I'm so grateful for Servant Leadership Institute publishing the book. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's an exciting project. So. We can't wait to see how many lives it's going to impact.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I went to college to play baseball, but as you know, to play a sport, you got to go to class. And so I didn't really know what I wanted to study, but ironically, my father, like you, was a finance guy, was an accountant. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll study accounting. Mm-hmm. And quickly figured out that me and numbers didn't get along that well and that... you know, the debits and credits weren't as simple as everybody said they were. And so then I think I tried finance and then I tried marketing. You know, it seemed a little softer and a little more human and, you know, not so numbers driven. And then somehow I stumbled onto not human resources the way we would think about it today as the sort of the science of human resources, but I stumbled more onto what you would call the human side of leadership, of management. So I ended up getting my undergraduate degree in management. And even though this is the mid-70s, I remember like yesterday, you know, there was all this excited talk in the 70s of moving away from theory X management and remember to theory Y. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember this.
Yeah, we are, yep.
And for our young listeners, Google it.
Right, Google it, right, yeah.
So you remember theory Y came along and kind of challenged the theory X theories that human beings needed to be cajoled to work hard and kind of pushed and bossed around and motivated by paychecks or whatever. And, you know, Theory Y came along and said, no, I don't. They theorized that maybe humankind isn't that way after all and that there's a human desire actually to work and create good goods and to give a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Mm-hmm. So hearing all that just made me love the human side of the marketplace. And while I graduated with that degree from Cal Poly in Pomona here in California, I always joke that I've never had a real job. I ended up going into the ministry. But as I say in the book, no one should picture me just playing golf and writing sermons. I mean, I've been the president of several large organizations and have had to deal with any kind of leadership that anybody in a small or medium corporation anywhere in America. I mean, I can't say I've been the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or something, but I've run the equivalent of, you know, small to medium-sized businesses my whole life. They just happen to have been nonprofit or religious.
Right. I remember that meeting in our office. You were just, you either had made the decision or were about to make the decision to move away from that large organization and find something else to do.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I was thinking about just kind of really writing and speaking for a living. I'd finished my doctoral work and I'd published my first couple of books and had other publishing opportunities and thought I would just kind of write and speak. And lo and behold, I ended up, you know, being a bishop that runs now basically a national organization.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's that something, some seed was planted in me in college that made me care about kind of the psychology of the workplace and the social psychology of how leadership and followership works in any organization, whether it's business or education or,
mm-hmm.
you know, finance or medical or whatever. There's a relationship that exists between leaders and followers that I've just always found fascinating.
Fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. Yes, I agree. Compared to what drew you in the 70s and 80s, compare that relationship today to the leaders and followers compared to what it was in the 70s. You kind of touched on that a little bit, but there seems to be a drastic change in that relationship.
Yeah, and I've always stayed up the best I can on sort of current leadership and management theory. I read the important books that come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that on the one hand, it feels like we're way better educated about this than we would have been 40 years ago. There's a lot more really valuable information out there for anybody who wants to read it, and great authors who your audience would be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, I feel like we know a lot more. But ironically, and I don't know that I would know the answer to this, it seems like the cynicism's worse. That the actual relationship between the workforce and that workforce leadership, there seems to be more cynicism than ever. And I don't know if that grows out of a sense of entitlement or if it grows out of fear that companies don't have our best interests at heart and therefore we have to protect ourselves. And, you mm-hmm. know, our generation, invented that phrase, the man, or, stick it to the man,
yeah,
which right. really meant, any big institution, whether it was a government or a company or something. And so I think that issue actually of the man may be worse here in 2016 than it was in the 60s, meaning kind of a fundamental mistrust of any kind of institution.
Right. And we were taught in college, we were challenge
yeah.
everything. You
right.
challenge everything.
Oh, yeah.
All
especially
authority,
power.
Everything. Power, you challenge it. Right. Yeah. So,
one of the people you've introduced me to, Mr. Covey and his work on the speed of trust. I just think, I know some of your listeners are familiar with him and his work.
Right.
I mean, if we knew nothing else except for what Covey's taught us about the speed of trust, that would be enough, I think, to make anybody care about servant leadership. If you just had that one insight.
It should be, right. I agree. Yeah. The trust is the main issue. And, your character at work, you really start, you got to have that trust with God first.
Right.
Right, and then
right.
He let him work on your heart
as
a leader and listen to what he has in front of you and build your own character.
Right.
The title Character at Work. Talk a little bit about the title Character at Work and what you would like to see happen with this book.
Yeah.
How would you like to influence the readers of the book?
Right. Well, when your team and I came up with the title Our Character at Work, it's kind of a double entendre. Meaning we have a character that we bring with us every day to work, and so it's that character at our workplace.
Uh-huh.
But the double entendre is it's also our character being worked on as we execute our various tasks of leadership day in and day out.
Uh-huh.
So essentially what I'm saying in the book art is something like this. I mean, I just speaking for myself, I've come to your conferences now for as long as you've had them. As I said, I read the important leadership literature. And so I just, at my age, I just turned 60 a week or so ago, and I've been leading on, one way or another for 40 years now. So I kind of feel like I'm at that place in life where I'm allowed to have an opinion.
Yeah, exactly, right.
And so I feel like I know somewhere in my knower that we sit and we listen to these wonderful people talk about the attributes, let's say, of servant leaders, that servant leaders are good listeners. So let's just think of some basic ones. Servant leaders are good listeners. Servant leaders care about the opinions of others. Servant leaders sort of naturally care about their people. So you hear people talk about this, or you hear somebody like Covey, you know, talk about becoming a trusting person and developing trust. Well, what if your basic instinct is actually to not be trusting? So you hear a great talk, you fly home, and the next day you're at work in a meeting, and that thing in you that actually doesn't trust people, as soon as the pressure's on, you behave out of what's real inside of you, not out of the talk you just heard. The talk you just heard may be aspirational. You may actually give mental assent to it. Like, yes, I believe what I heard Maxwell say, or Covey, or Ken Blanchard, or any of the people we all, you know, read and care about. So we read their stuff, we hear it, and we think, yes, I am actually committed to being that kind of person. But the theory of this book, Art, is we act in the way we're prepared to act, not in the way we wish we could. For instance, my wife Debbie might say, Todd, let's learn to dance. Well, if I tried to dance, I would dance according to who I am, which is uncoordinated.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter my aspiration. If I'm actually going to dance, I have to learn to re-coordinate my body. And that can be done, but it's a journey.
It is a journey. Yeah, I agree.
You know, you can't show up to a staff meeting and say, I'm going to listen this morning. You have to become the kind of person for whom listening is native to you. It's natural, which that's what we explore in the book is, well, how do I change those deep inside parts of me, whether you want to call it your heart or your soul or your current system of desires, however you might want to think about that. And this is where Art, the book does get, excuse me, quote unquote, as you said, religious, but I know that neither you nor I nor Servant Leadership Institute intend the book to be religious in a negative way. It's just that the basic thesis comes from who I would want to say is the smartest man who ever lived, mm-hmm. and who had the best insight on human nature, and that's Jesus, the historic Jesus, who taught that it's out of the abundance of the heart that human beings speak and act, have behaviors and attitudes. And I just think Jesus is a genius. Now, you don't have to be a Christian. I know you well enough to know that we're not speaking against any other world religion.
Exactly.
We're just taking Jesus as a teacher. Mm-hmm. No matter what else somebody might think about him, he is the towering figure of human history, and there's a reason for that. And one of the reasons is his teachings. When his contemporaries heard him teach, they would say things like, we have never heard anyone teach with this kind of insight, with this kind of authority. That, like, where does this come from? People would ask him, where does this come from? And so what we're trying to set forth in the book is an intelligent but doable way of working on our heart so that the behaviors of servant leadership become instinctual.
Right. Now I'm going to go back to you're talking about being in a seminar and saying, hey, this is how I want to be. This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And you go back into the real world, as we call it, and mm-hmm. the pressures take over.
Right.
And that character kind of gets suppressed.
Right.
There was a study last year that I was made aware of folks that were in the last season of their life. And they wanted to go ask hospice nurses, what do people talk about? What's their biggest regret when they're in that last seasons of life in a hospice situation?
Yeah.
And the nurses said, by far, people regretted that they didn't live the life that was inside of them.
Mm.
They lived the life that was expected of them.
Right.
And that's kind of what you're talking about, right? We have this desire to have a great character
mm-hmm.
and serve people and help people. And then we get in the world around us and we don't know how to deal with it. We don't know how to deal with the barriers first with ourselves
right.
that we're going to have, and then with others around us.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Help the folks understand a little bit about some of the things you talk about in the book that help those individuals with their own self barriers when they get in that real world environment.
Yeah, I think what happens there is we almost feel like we betrayed ourselves.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because those vows of wanting to be a good servant leader, like, you know, take somebody like our friend, you know, Cheryl Batchelder at Popeyes. You know, she's such an amazing human being. And so, like, we see her and we hear her story. Like, she's actually...
She is amazing. Yep.
She's actually pulled this off.
Uh-huh.
And so something in our brain attaches to that.
Uh-huh.
And we want to do it. And to your point, but we get back into our workplace and those external pressures begin to work on us, and then we behave in ways that feels like it betrays our own wishes. And mm-hmm. we're all like, well, what the heck? I think I really do want this. What the heck is wrong with me? Why can't I live into this thing that I think I want?
Mm-hmm.
And for our listeners who might play golf or know a little bit of golf, I mean, that's just like saying, I want to hit a draw here, but I can't.
I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. I am not capable of hitting a draw.
Mm-hmm.
Or a high fade, or if you're a tennis player, I want to hit a drop shot here, but the angle of my racket is routinely wrong. Or if you're a musician, I want to be able to play this certain riff, but you can't.
Can't do it. Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do in the book is walk that back and say, okay, well, how do you become the kind of person who could?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important to say here, Art, that it is possible. Perfection's never in view. Right? I mean, I don't know about you.
No. Perfection's never in view. You're exactly right there. Yeah.
And in some ways, I wouldn't have known the term servant leadership, but in some ways, I've been working on this for myself for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have moments of impatience where I can't listen. Like, I don't have the emotional energy to listen. So let's pick on me for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So I vow in a certain day or in a certain meeting to be a great listener. And I get in the meeting and I can't. Mm-hmm. I'm distracted. I'm actually not present.
Mm-hmm.
So all this book really does is say, okay, without judgment, without guilt, without shame, just notice that that's real. And ask yourself, why aren't you present here?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe what I notice is, I don't have the emotional or intellectual energy today.
That's right. We have to recognize when we're on our high.
Yeah,
and we can be that servant leader,
mm-hmm.
but also recognize when you're on that emotional low.
Yeah,
and you're in that I call it the danger zone. Right,
yeah.
We have our danger zone that
right.
we know, whoever's going to disagree with us at that moment, we're not going to have a good relation or a good response to it.
Yeah.
So.
So the way this thinking goes is, and again, I'll keep picking on myself because this is actually.
That's good. I like picking on you because don't pick on me.
Don't talk
about me.
This is actually a real story.
Yeah, okay, good.
So I noticed that maybe, okay, I don't have the emotional or intellectual, spiritual energy this morning to live out that vow to be a really good listener.
Mm-hmm.
So then I do the kind of heart work that I talk about in the book. And so I ask myself, well, how did I show up here this morning without the energy needed to live out my vow? And maybe I recognize something as simple as I'm not getting enough sleep.
Right.
And then you ask why. And maybe I get to, well, my calendar's really full. And you just keep asking, well, why? And maybe, Art, what I get to is that I don't actually think much of myself, and I'm afraid others won't think much of me unless I'm busy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one way we know important people today is they're busy.
They're busy.
I mean, that's the best way for people to think that you're important. So then I have to ask myself, now I'm down to my character. Now I have to ask myself, okay, how can I unhook myself from the need to be busy mm-hmm. so that I think good of me or that others think good of me? So you see the logic there, the sort of step down, like we're stepping down into the realest parts of our heart so that and again, I want to emphasize, without guilt, without shame, just noticing the way a dentist would say, you've got a cavity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that shouldn't produce guilt or shame. It's just, okay, I got to deal with this.
But, in today's world, a lot of people will start the conversation with, I know you're busy.
Yeah.
Or, I didn't call you and because I know you're really busy right now, et cetera. And,
and
I like to tell people, let me decide if I'm busy.
Yeah.
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 Busy is an interesting word. I was with Ken Blanchard a couple months ago, and he gave the group that was listening to him a new definition of busy.
What was that?
Being under Satan's yoke.
Oh, yeah.
Think about that. Yeah. You're a person of faith, and you've got all this busy stuff going on. Do you have the right priorities in your life? Do you have? Are you listening to God? Are you spending some time with them?
Right.
That's
Or my friend Richard Foster used to say, "Hurry isn't of the devil. Hurry is the devil."
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So in this, everybody wants to be busy. Everybody wants to be going, and especially parents that have kids that are involved in soccer. And we had one person in the company the other day said, I got to go up north to a soccer tournament. I hope they don't win. Because if they win, I got to go back up there the next weekend.
Right, yeah.
You know, and they get worn down. They can't enjoy life anymore. And yeah, so.
And I'm not at all, obviously, against technology. And even if I was, it's stupid. It's not going to go anywhere. I mean, I got a smartphone, and I love my MacBook Pro. And, you know, I'm connected like you and everybody else is. But I do think we have to notice how even technology, it pushes buttons in our brain, you know, the constant dinging of our phones and computers and notices. It's eroding our ability to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's eroding our ability to think deeply. And that's one of the things a servant leader needs, because if you can't, if your mind is constantly distracted, you can't be present. And if you're not present to your people, they know it immediately. And it doesn't feel loving, it doesn't feel caring, it doesn't make them feel safe. So I just want to say that's another little thing that mm-hmm. we can just learn to manage. Maybe you turn off some notifications, or you handle your emails in a different way so that you can learn to be present to your actual life.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you gave me a devotion at Christmas time. And so when I started looking at it in January, and it came through and said, you really need to spend time alone once a week.
Yeah.
And then once a month, you need to go spend an entire day by yourself.
Right.
And then once a quarter, you need to go off for a couple of days. And yeah. I'm going, I don't have time for all that alone time, number one. And number two, I'm not sure I want to be with myself for that long, right?
Actually a common reaction. I'm not sure I like myself
that much. I don't want to be together with myself that long, right? Yeah. So you've gotten a lot of your inspiration. You mentioned Max Dupree many times in your book. Talk about the influence he's had on your life and what you believe in servant leadership and what you portray in the book.
Yes, I mean, sitting here today, I can't remember, maybe you can, the year that he wrote Leadership is an Art. I feel like I was in college, so that would be the 70s, but it might have been a little bit later than that. So Max's book, Leadership is an Art, Leadership Jazz, and my favorite one is Leading Without Power.
Mm-hmm.
And Max wrote that one to the audience that we're trying to talk to today, to kind of the nonprofit people, church people who don't have the normal levers of power that you would have, let's say, in the military or in corporations. Now, I think everybody can read that book and benefit by it. But I think the thing that most stands out to me from Dupree is that any enterprise has to have a moral purpose. And for Max, one of the moral purposes of any enterprise, and for our listeners who don't know who he is, he was the CEO of that famous furniture company, Herman Miller.
Right, yep.
He's now elderly and retired, and served on the board of Fuller Seminary for decades, and I'm sure other places as well. But the story I'll never forget that I think comes from Leadership as an Art is that he had a millwright in one of his shops that was, you know, who knows, making plastics or metals or something for desks and chairs. This millwright dies. And so Max goes to the funeral. And after the funeral, you know, this is a small Midwest town, is invited over to the widow's house for a bite to eat. And he goes. Mm-hmm. This classic servant leader, right? So he goes. He's present to his people. And as he's sitting there in the living room, he sees on the table a book of poetry, and he begins to read it. And it's actually quite good poetry. And the wife tells him, oh, yes, whatever the guy's name was, let's say Frank, Frank wrote this. And what Dupree said is he had one of his major aha moments then when he asked himself the question, was Frank a poet who did mill work? Or was he a mill worker who wrote poetry? And what Max said he realized at that time is that he was not seeing his employees as whole persons.
As whole persons. Mm-hmm.
And allowing them to bring their whole person to the workplace. I know this sounds a little idealistic, but as much as possible, allowing whole persons as they walk through our front doors. And what Max wants to say is they're sort of delivered into our payroll systems or org charts as fully formed humans, and that one of our jobs as servant leaders is to help them be full human beings.
Exactly.
And leverage that, and I don't mean that in a utilitarian way, but leverage it, leverage their gifts, use their gifts, make space for their gifts the best we can, because that's not only good for them, Mm-hmm. But it's good for the company or the enterprise. It's good, as you would know better than I, for the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sort of the business case for servant leadership has been made by you and others many times. I don't really tackle that in my book. My book is more, you know, how can we, like think of the heart that Dupree is exhibiting there. And what I try to ask and answer in my book is, okay, how do we cultivate that kind of heart? Because I'm convinced that consistent servant leadership comes out of a heart, not a mental assent to behaviors that servant leadership authors tell us we should do.
Right. And you know, everyone, their life doesn't exist between 8 and 5.
Yeah, exactly.
Every day, right?
Right.
And they're going to bring their life into the workplace.
Yeah.
And I think he was pretty smart, because we call it the helping people through the unfolding of their lives events.
Yes.
Everybody's got events that are going to impact who they are and what they do every day.
Right.
Both positive and negative. And yeah. We need to help them through that. So.
Yeah.
That's great. We got a couple more questions I want to get through here. Your own pain and being a victim of leadership malpractice. I know that motivated you to write some things in the book. So just share one or two things there that in your experience that you've shared that pain of being under a power leader.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that goes wrong here is if you're with a leader who you actually admire, or there are traits or aspects of this leader you admire, could just be their success or whatever. So I was around a person like this, and I remember this person saying to me in a group of key leaders who had really helped build this enterprise. Now, he was obviously the top dog and the most famous, but literally we had, you know, built this thing together. At one point we're sitting in a meeting and he says, you know, you guys are all just sled dogs pulling my sled, and I get new dogs anytime I want.
Sled dogs?
Uh-huh. And I remember thinking, wow. And because he was winning, it was a way to win an argument. So many years ago now, I don't even know what we were debating.
Uh-huh.
But his team, in a sense, was against him. I don't mean personally. Like, he had staked out a position about something, and the team was somewhere else. And in order to win the argument and get out of that moment, he basically just dissed us all.
Exactly, right.
Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't characterize his leadership. I still love this man. But it's a classic moment to me of power, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of picking up power and using it to actually shut down your team. And so, you know, again, one of the things I talk about in the book is those kind of short-term wins are really dumb, because it so demotivates this team who helped build this
thing
for you. And in order for you to win, you actually make everybody else lose.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to work with a team of people who you convince that they're losers?
You don't, yeah.
Like, how crazy is that?
I had a leader that I worked for once. He got senior staff together one day and told us flat out, Todd, I don't trust anyone in this room.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm going to ask you for information. I'm going to make the decisions. Just give me the information I asked for, yeah, and I'll take it from there.
Yeah.
And we left the room going, did he really just say that to us? He doesn't trust anyone?
Because that's like a form of insanity.
And he wants us to bust our tail to help him be successful. And
yeah,
2 years later, he lost his job because he didn't perform. And we go, okay, well, duh. I mean, he didn't generate any trust, any relationships with anyone.
Right.
And nobody would get behind him, and that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like the leader who says, oh, "Doggone it! Why am I always the last person to hear something?"
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, because no one wants to tell you the truth.
Yeah,
you know, who's going to tell you the truth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh man, so you've been around servant leadership pretty much since it's about a year after its inception, I think, and we were kicking around an idea of you're doing some work with us, but we've been working with you pretty much every year, and you've done some stuff for us, and we've supported you in your ministry and your work.
Yeah.
For the people of faith that are listening today, who are struggling with the idea of taking their faith in the workplace and that fear that's keeping them from doing it, what kind of words of wisdom do you have or can you point to in your book that help them deal with that fear?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is a negative. And that is, whatever you do, don't become the office nag.
Mm-hmm.
Our culture already thinks the church is just, our role in culture is just to be a moral nag. So whatever we do, we don't want to become a moral nag. On the other hand, I think what we want to do is go on the journey that I suggest in this book of our own inner transformation. And again, you don't have to be a Christian to benefit from this book. I want to say again, neither Art nor I or Servant Leadership are trying to shove religion down anybody's throat. But I think some of the things that Jesus taught are just manifestly true. They've stood the test of time for 2,000 years, and no one doubts them. So one of the things that Jesus said is that when you become a different kind of person, the effect of that is you become a light on a hill. Now, you know, like you, I fly all the time, and I don't know how many times I've flown over Las Vegas coming home at night, and you know, you just can't hide Las Vegas.
You can't, no. Nope. Oh.
Even with cloud cover, you see the vague lights, right, of Vegas. And that's what Jesus meant to say, is that if we can transform our own inner character so that we can actually become consistent, routine servant leaders, that will have its own effect. It's like salt. It's like light. And you don't have to nag. You don't even have to, in a sense, promote yourself. Just become the kind of leader who creates a team or a workforce that is solid and produces good results, and that is going to have its own effect. Mm-hmm. So I would say, in a sense, keep it personal, meaning let that be the starting point, your own heart, your own mind, your own internal structure of your desires from which you behave. And as you begin to change that, people are going to notice it. So just go gently and humbly on the journey and let it have its own effect.
Yeah, great, great, great advice. Todd's helped me in my walk in servant leadership, and you've been a great, great prayer partner for me and somebody I can go to that I can share things with. And
yeah. Well, you're so welcome.
I really encourage you guys, get this book. Read it, study it, listen to what Todd has to say. If you have a chance to go hear him speak anywhere, you got to go. You got to listen to him speak, because he's a very, very wise man, you know, when it comes to leadership and faith. So, Todd, loved having you with us today.
Thank you. My privilege. Great to be with you.
We'll be talking more about this book and on some future events, but we're excited to be part of this project with you, and of course, we wish you the best.
Thanks
for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
All right, thanks.
We hope you enjoyed our episode, and we encourage you to pick up a copy or download a copy of Our Character at Work, available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. As a special treat for you, the first 5 people to email us with your contact information at info@servantleadershipinstitute.com will receive a copy of the book signed by Todd Hunter. Once again, that's info@servantleadershipinstitute.com. Thanks for listening and allowing us to add value to your day.